Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Major earthquake affects Afghanistan and Pakistan. A major earthquake struck a remote area of northern Afghanistan on Monday, killing more than 150 people there and in neighboring Pakistan and injuring hundreds more. Centered 82 kilometers southeast of Faizabad in a remote area of the Hindu Kush mountain range, the quake Monday registered at a magnitude of 7.5, that according to the U.S. Geological Survey. VOA's Ayaz Ghul felt the effects from his home in Islamabad.
Well, this was around lunchtime, 2 p.m. Local time, when this earthquake struck Pakistan, and it was so strong that we could even feel it here in Islamabad. And all I was with my family, with my mother, and we all had to flee the home, and we just took refuge among this big group of people who were already out there on the street. And we could see our homes, our houses and buildings around us. They were really shaking. And we just thought that they're going to come down anytime soon.
The hardest hit area was Pakistan's northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, where officials have confirmed at least 123 people killed and more than 950 were injured. Pakistan's military chief, General Rashid Sharif, mobilized troops and helicopters to immediately distribute rescue equipment to the region. 28 people are reported dead in Afghanistan, but that number could rise dramatically, according to the country's CEO, Abdullah Abdullah. This is VOA News. Turkish officials say 9 people have been killed, including 2 police officers, in a raid on a suspected Islamic State cell in southeast Turkey. The raid comes as security forces are intensifying their efforts against the jihadist group following a twin suicide bombing in the capital of Ankara earlier this month that officials blame on Islamic State militants. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Predominantly Kurdish region is close to the Syrian border and is widely believed to be a recruitment center for jihadists fighting in Iraq and Syria. Turkish officials have implicated the Islamic State group in the bombing of a peace rally in the capital Ankara earlier this month. Sinan Ulgen, a visiting scholar of the Carnegie Institute in Brussels, says the attack has prompted a change in policy by Ankara towards the jihadists.
There has been indeed quite a bit of criticism of Turkey acting more cautious than what its Western partners wanted in the fight against IS. There has been also criticism of Turkish policy that was viewed as being too negligent on IS.
Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Mr. Olgun also said they're hoping to see more enthusiasm on the Turkish side to participate in the fight against ISIS. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad told a Russian parliamentary delegation on Sunday his country must first eliminate the terrorist threat as a way to reach a political solution to his country's nearly 5-year civil war and possibly new elections. A state-run Sana news agency said Mr. Assad stressed that taking out terrorist groups would preserve Syria's sovereignty and its territorial integrity. Analyst Joseph Olmert of the University of South Carolina says that this is a little bit of the same old, same old.
We may feel a bit more secure these days due to the Russian intervention, even though I must tell you that a lot of things happening in Syria on the ground, which are not coming to the attention of the Western media, in various areas of the country, which indicate to me that as of now, the real actual situation on the ground there hasn't changed in a dramatic way or in a fundamental way.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov discussed the prospects for an internationally backed political settlement in Syria. An opposition leader is claiming victory in Sunday's Republic of Congo referendum because of what he calls very poor turnout. Guy Kinfuzia Romain, the president of the Union for Democracy and Republic Party, said the Congolese people heeded the opposition's call to stay home because the referendum is an illegal means to keep President Denis Sassou Nguesso in power. For more on all these stories, visit our website at voanews.com. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Up to this point, there's no clear indication who is winning at the presidential level. They're releasing the results in rather piecemeal fashion from isolated parts of Tanzania.
That's VOA's Vincent Makori reporting on the vote count in the Tanzanian elections. Details coming up. Also in the news, in Ivory Coast, electoral officials continue to count the ballots from yesterday's presidential election. And South Sudan's rebels signed an agreement today to finalize the implementation of the security arrangements that were part of an August peace accord. We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, they're counting the votes in Tanzania following yesterday's presidential and parliamentary elections. However, it is expected to be several days before we learn whether the opposition has unseated the ruling party, which has been in power for more than 50 years. VOA's Africa 54 host Vincent Makori is in Dar es Salaam and is monitoring the ballot count. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua about the elections.
Up to this point, there's no clear indication who is winning at the presidential level. They're releasing the results in rather piecemeal fashion from isolated parts of Tanzania. And therefore, at this point, it's really not easy to tell who of the presidential candidates is ahead of the other.
Any idea when the results will be in?
The electoral commission says that they are allowed by the law to take up to 7 days. They've actually said that they're likely to announce this on Thursday. There's a possibility it could be done on Friday, but certainly before Saturday.
Now, of course, there were also parliamentary elections. Can you give me the latest on those?
The way it's being done is that the electoral commission officials are releasing the parliamentary elections without piecemeal. And so they are giving numbers from different regions of Tanzania. And so up to this point, it looks like the CCM party, the ruling party, has secured a little more in terms of parliamentary seats. But again, it's because the results have not been announced from so many of the regions and people are getting impatient. It is expected that perhaps by this evening, people may have a better picture as to who is having more seats in parliament.
Have you heard of any reports of irregularities or violence or anything like that?
There are no massive issues of irregularities, but there have been reports in isolated polling stations where, for example, they claim that some officials try to interfere by perhaps withholding some ballots or trying in a way to manipulate the system so that they can add numbers, add ballots that belong to one candidate to the other one. But it's not a widespread issue. It's fairly isolated. But in terms of demonstrations and protests, you have witnessed some in Zanzibar, where the opposition presidential candidate for Zanzibar announced himself the winner and was calling on the Electoral Commission to confirm that. So there was some protest earlier by his supporters who want to see him declare the president in Zanzibar.
Vincent, what is the mood like now in Tanzania following the vote?
It is fairly tense. People are very, very concerned because it looks like on either side, each is expecting to win this election. There's an appearance that it will be a close election, and therefore, depending on who wins, the other side might dispute it. So people are fairly tense, and they hope that it will go on peacefully at the end when they do announce the final result, especially for the presidential candidate.
That's VOA's Africa 54 host Vincent Makori from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua. In the Republic of Congo, results have not yet been announced in a crucial and controversial referendum. If approved, it would change the constitution before next year's presidential election and pave the way for President Denis Sassou Nguesso to run again. The current constitution prohibits a third presidential term and bars candidates over 70 years of age. Mr. Sassou Nguesso will be 71 at the time of the scheduled 2016 election. Many opponents boycotted the referendum to protest Mr. Sassou Nguesso's desire to run for a third consecutive term. He has served as president for 30 of the past 36 years. He won the last election with 79% of the vote. Opposition leaders say results of yesterday's referendum should be annulled because of a low voter turnout. Guy Kinfasia-Romaine, president of the Opposition Union for Democracy and Republic Party, says the Congolese people heeded the call to stay at home. He calls the referendum an illegal means to keep the president in power. In Ivory Coast, electoral officials continue to count the ballots from yesterday's presidential election. President Alassane Ouattara is expected to win a second term in office. Election observers say overall the election appears to have been free and fair. Reporter Emily Ayoub is following the vote count. From the capital, Abidjan, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about the election.
Well, the Electoral Commission just announced today that the turnout percentage was around 60%. And they've also said that they're going to issue the first result of the election. We don't know yet when, but they said it's going to be today, the first results.
When you say the first results, what does that exactly mean?
It's the preliminary result. They're still counting votes.
And when do you think the final results might be in?
Well, by law, the Electoral Commission has 5 days to release the full results. They said they hope to release the full results within 48 hours, so that means by Tuesday evening.
Now, as you mentioned, the turnout was about 60%. Was that considered greater than what was expected prior to the vote?
It is for sure lower than the turnout of the first round in 2010, which was 80%. There was a fear that it's going to be a lower turnout, partly because part of the opposition boycotted the voting. So 60% is considered average.
What did observers have to say about yesterday's vote?
The observers reported minor incidents like polling station opening later than scheduled and some also problem with voting equipment, but they've just repeated today that these incidents were not big enough to provoke any major disturbance.
That's reporter Emily Ayoub from the Ivory Coast capital of Abidjan. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capwell. South Sudan's rebels signed an agreement today to finalize the implementation of the security arrangements that were part of an August peace accord. Fighting has continued despite that ceasefire, but these latest developments has all parties hopeful. Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
A delegation of South Sudan's rebel forces signed the details of security arrangements Monday morning. The government delegation and a group of former political leaders and detainees signed the agreement in September, but the rebels had refused. General Taban Dengai says the rebels delayed because they were concerned about the volume of troops in the capital city, Juba.
The government had an understanding that the 5,000 mentioned in the minutes were just only for them. But now they are understanding that we are going to share them. They are going to be shared between the two parties. This will be the first unit of the army to be unified.
Talks will continue to decide on the details of the shared forces. IGAD, the East African bloc mediating, is hopeful for more progress after the signing Monday morning. South Sudan's Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, Peter Bashir, calls the signing a breakthrough as talks have been going on for 22 months.
This minutes, as per the agreement, is supposed to be the operationalization of the permanent ceasefire and transition of security arrangements, which is key for the implementation of the other provisions.
A political rift between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy turned violent in December 2013. The conflict has left millions displaced and in need of humanitarian assistance. The UN warned this month that nearly 4 million people in South Sudan face severe food insecurity, including tens of thousands on the brink of famine in war-torn Unity State. Several ceasefires have been signed since January 2014, but none of them has brought peace. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
After meeting yesterday with other EU leaders, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras say they plan to build reception centres for migrants and refugees travelling through Greece and several Balkan states. Despite increasing criticism at home, Ms. Merkel has called for another emergency EU meeting to reach a concrete agreement. She says Europe must show it is a continent of humanitarian values. EU officials also say they will send 400 policemen to Slovenia on the EU's eastern boundary to control massive numbers of migrants entering there. Poland's Conservative Law and Justice Party claimed victory in yesterday's parliamentary election. The party has campaigned against the resettlement of Muslims, the use of the European Union currency, and increased spending in welfare programs. Meanwhile, the Czech Republic's president says in a newspaper interview that most refugees don't deserve compassion because they use their children as shields. Miloš Zeman says, as a rule, the migrants are young and healthy men who carry iPads and iPhones and have thousands of euros and thousands of dollars in their pockets. The nation's prime minister has disputed Mr. Zeman's views. And also, Greek authorities say four migrants drowned in two incidents in the Aegean. One man was found dead on the island of Chios today. Yesterday, three drowned in waters off the island of Lesbos, and seven others are still missing. The Greek Coast Guard rescued more than 460 migrants over the weekend. Of the more than 500,000 who have tried to sail from Turkey to Greece this year, 120 have drowned. Seventeen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. In recent years, Turkey has invested considerable diplomatic and economic energy in sub-Saharan Africa. Observers say the continent is a small part of its total global trade, but growing rapidly. Turkish economists say Ankara does nearly $10 billion worth of business with the region, double that if trade with North Africa is included. Turkey is also an important source of economic support for East Africa, investing over $1 billion in recent years in Ethiopia alone. David Sheehan is an adjunct professor in the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He's also a former U.S. ambassador to Burkina Faso and Ethiopia and former U.S. Foreign Service officer with assignments in embassies in Kenya, Tanzania, Mauritania, Cameroon, and Sudan. Reporter William Eagle asked Ambassador Sheehan, what are Turkey's main interests in sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, the same interest that every other major country has, including the United States and China, and that is to try to obtain the support of as many of the African countries as one can. Turkey has aspirations from time to time, for example, to be elected as a non-permanent member of the Security Council and the UN, and they need African support for that. Although it's a quiet issue now, there have been occasions when Cyprus has been a troublesome issue for Turkey, and it needs support outside of Turkey for its position on Cyprus. It's an economic fora, World Trade Organization, similar organizations where Africans are well represented. It's looking for a certain amount of support. So it's pretty much across the globe in terms of the issues that come up where the Africans have some influence and ability to help determine the outcome.
Does Turkey play a complementary role to Western interests in Africa, or at times does it also play a bit of a challenger?
In terms of Africa, I would say that the Turkish effort tends to be more complementary than it is competitive. Now, there will be obvious commercial competition that Turkey has with all major trading and investing countries in Africa, and that's normal. There's nothing unusual about that. In fact, to the extent that there is any competition between Turkey and other countries, it's probably more with countries like China and India than it is the United States and the European countries. And there is plenty of competition at that level. But in terms of what other countries around the world would like to see happen in Africa, including the United States, both politically and economically, that is, in terms of economic development and political stability, I think the Turkish position is not significantly different than that of the United States. As a result, they're looking for economic development and indeed contributing to economic development in sub-Saharan Africa. I think they're also in favor of political stability. They have made a particular effort to reach out in the case of Somalia and arguably are playing the lead role in Somalia of any single other country. I think that's the only country in Africa where I would argue that Turkey has, in effect, the leading role. But it's playing an important role in places like Ethiopia, Sudan, and trying to extend its influence beyond that, although with some difficulty once you get beyond Northeast Africa.
You mentioned Turkish involvement in Somalia. What is the leading role there? Because we also mentioned, and you mentioned in your research, that, of course, Al-Shabaab seems to have a very poor relationship with Turkey. There's a bit of enmity there. Does that not complicate matters for Turkey, at least on a diplomatic level, or being an honest broker in the Somali conflicts?
Well, Turkey is, you're right. Al-Shabaab poses a dilemma for anyone operating in Somalia who's trying to put an end, as it were, to the Al-Shabaab movement, which includes the European countries, the United States, Turkey, China, many others. So to that extent, Turkey is facing pretty much the same situation that everyone else is facing there. It's just that they're more exposed on the ground than, say, the United States. I mean, they have far more people on the ground than the United States does. The role that Turkey is playing in Somalia beyond trying to deal with the Al-Shabaab threat is to reconcile Somaliland and Somalia, and they've been playing the mediating role in that effort. For the time being, it's sort of at a hiatus, not really moving at all, and it's not clear that that talks are going to resume anytime soon. But if they do resume, it'll probably be under the aegis of Turkey, as the most recent talks have been. It's also playing a major developmental role in Somalia, in Mogadishu. And it has a diplomatic mission, a consular mission in Hargeisa, the capital of Somaliland, and it has an embassy with an ambassador on the ground in Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia. Turkish Air is the first major airline to start flying in and out of Somalia, and the leadership of Turkey has made several high-level visits to Mogadishu at a time when no other non-Africans were doing that. So they've put an awful lot into the Somali basket, and then you have civil society organizations that are very Turkish civil society organizations that are very active in Somalia. So when you add it all up, it's a major engagement by Turkey in Somalia.
That was David Sheen, an adjunct professor in the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University in Washington. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. Zimbabwe is one of the countries hardest hit by the AIDS epidemic. For the past couple of years, the government has been urging men to get circumcised, a procedure that lowers the risk of getting infected with the HIV virus. Now officials are pushing the newly introduced ring method that makes the procedure easier. Sebastian Mumfu reports from the rural district of Shurugwi.
These men have just been circumcised using the ring method. They watch a football match as others undergo the procedure in a nearby tent. The technique involves inserting a plastic ring inside the foreskin. A rubber ring is placed on the outside. The ring blocks the blood flow to the foreskin, and in a few days, both the ring and the foreskin can be removed. In 2009, the government set the target to have 1.3 million men circumcised by 2017 to slow the spread of HIV. Zimbabwe was falling short of this target with the surgical method, according to Mauven Nyamana, the chief medical officer in Shurugwe Rural District. He says the ring method introduced this year has made a big difference.
We are seeing that a lot of particular population were not keen on coming for circumcision, especially the young adults and the older men ranging from 18 to around 29 are now willing to come because of this method, which saves time. They just want to come in and go with no injections, with less hassles, and continue with their daily business as usual.
He says the ring method is less painful and less expensive. An 18-year-old man heads out to play football after his procedure. He says with the ring method, you can do all your usual chores. He says some people like me were afraid of surgical circumcision, but there's nothing to be afraid of with the ring method. Nothing has changed since I got the ring on me. Zimbabwe rolled out the ring method with the funding from the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, and the Population Services International, PSI. The World Health Organization says there's compelling evidence that male circumcision reduces the risk of HIV infection in men by approximately 60%. However, the UN body specifies that male circumcision only reduces, not eliminates, the risk. It says people should still use protection, practice abstinence, and avoid multiple sex partners. That is the same message Zimbabwean health officials preach to men here before they line up to be circumcised. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Shurugwe, Zimbabwe.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Let's Talk, turncoat. According to the dictionary, the word turncoat means a person who stops being a member of one group in order to join another group that opposes the first group. Do you want to know more? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing turncoat. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. They are counting the votes in Tanzania following yesterday's presidential and parliamentary elections. Also in Ivory Coast, electoral officials continue to count the ballots from yesterday's presidential election. And South Sudan's rebels signed an agreement today to finalize the implementation of a security arrangement. Coming up, music from Cameroon, and in our feature segment, a protein found in bananas being turned into a drug that may someday be used to fight viral infections. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sonny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Happy Monday, Yehiz.
Sonny, I understand you're beginning with the Rugby World Cup.
Yehiz, let's kick off with the Rugby World Cup in England. The Wallabies of Australia will battle the defending champion All Blacks of New Zealand in the final on October 31st at Twickenham Stadium in London. The winner of Saturday's championship match will be lifting the trophy for an unprecedented third time. The Aussies won world rugby titles in 1991 and 1999, while New Zealand won the championship in 1987 and 2011. The Wallabies and the All Blacks both posted semifinal victories over the weekend at Twickenham. Australia defeated Argentina 29-15, while New Zealand won a tight match against South Africa 20-18. South African rugby fans who watched the match in Johannesburg were disappointed with the result, of course, but they were also proud of their two-time champion Springboks. Let's listen in now to what a few of the South African fans had to say.
Very tight game, but a good game all in all. We expected that New Zealand would go through, but we were hoping.
It was a good game. We gave a good effort. 3 points short, but yeah, disappointed, but happy with it, guys.
I think the game was awesome. I'm very proud of the box. We made it this far, and New Zealand is a very tough team to play against, but we played very well. I'm very proud of the box. We did not make it, but you made it in our eyes, and we were very proud.
A better side on the day compared to us. I mean, there are two tries. We didn't have a try.
South African rugby fans reacting to their team's 20-18 semifinal loss to defending champion New Zealand. The Springboks will play Argentina Friday at the Olympic Stadium in London in the third place match. I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
And if you check out my Facebook page today, Monday, you'll see a nice photo of Ghana's IU brothers, Andre and Jordan, who battled on the pitch over the weekend in English Premier League football. In the photo, Andre has his right arm around Jordan as they walk off the field, and it looks like he's consoling his younger brother. Andre's Swansea City club scored a 2-1 road victory over Jordan's Aston Villa club in that match, one in which both of the IUs made their presence felt. Jordan opened the scoring in the 62nd minute, but Andre scored a late winner in the 87th minute for Swansea. One of my Ghanaian friends on Facebook, Peter Serigne, saw the photo of the IU brothers and responded, "Andre Dede IU fires Tim Sherwood." Well, I don't think Dede did the actual firing, but his goal certainly didn't help Sherwood's case. Struggling Aston Villa gave Sherwood the boot after the match and replaced him with caretaker manager Kevin McDonald. Aston Villa is currently at the very bottom of the Premier League standings with only 4 points from 10 matches. Meanwhile, Andre Ayew Swansea is currently in 12th place in the 20-team EPL with 13 points from 10 matches. Taking a look at the very top of the Premier League standings, Manchester City and Arsenal are currently tied for first place with 22 points each from 10 matches. West Ham and Manchester United are next with 20 points. In results from the weekend, Man City and Man U played a scoreless draw at Old Trafford. Arsenal defeated visiting Everton 2-1, and West Ham was a 2-1 winner over visiting Chelsea.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Voice of America.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. A South African businessman, anti-apartheid activist, and former political prisoner is throwing his hat into the ring to be the next FIFA president, as we hear now from the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi.
Former South African anti-apartheid campaigner Tokyo Sexwale, once jailed alongside Nelson Mandela, officially entered the race for the president of FIFA, the World Soccer's governing body. The 62-year-old diamond mining tycoon and former politician is the fifth official candidate for the February 26, 2016 election to succeed Sepp Blatter. No African has ever headed the 111-year organization, although President of African Football Confederation Issa Hayatou is the current interim president of FIFA. Sexwale decided to run after securing the full backing of the South African Football Association, SAFA. Other confirmed candidates ahead of the deadline this Monday are European Football Association Chief Michel Platini, Prince Ali bin Al Hussein of Jordan, former Trinidad and Tobago captain David Nakid, and former FIFA Deputy General Secretary Jerome Champagne.
Hello, this is Haile Gebrselassie. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sport on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Ethiopian runners won the men's and women's titles at the 2015 Frankfurt Marathon in Germany. In the men's event, Ethiopian Cissé Lema ran 2 hours, 6 minutes and 26 seconds to win, beating Kenyan duo of Lani Ruto and Alpha Slagat to the second and third places, respectively. In the women's race, another Ethiopian, Gulume Tulesa, emerged as a surprise winner in 2 hours, 23 minutes and 12 seconds, as Ethiopians made a clean sweep of the podium. Gulume ran a personal best by over 6 minutes to beat Denknesh Mekash in a sprint finish. Mekash was credited with the same time as Gulume, and their compatriots, Koren Jelela, continued her return with a third place finish in 2 hours, 23 minutes and 52 seconds. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoje here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brillafm.net. I tell you this. It's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
The National Basketball Association is mourning the death of Flip Saunders, the head coach and president of basketball operations for the Minnesota Timberwolves Club. Saunders died Sunday at age 60 of cancer. He was well-liked around the NBA, and he spent more than 20 years in the league. In addition to the Timberwolves, Flip Saunders also coached the Detroit Pistons and my favorite team, the Washington Wizards. Washington's all-star point guard, John Wall, was one of the players who paid tribute to Flip Saunders. Wall wrote on Instagram, and I quote, "The sting of losing another loved one to cancer doesn't get any easier. My thoughts and prayers are with the Saunders and Timberwolves family. Coach Saunders guided me into this league. He believed in me and taught me what it takes to be a good player and a better man. Rest in peace, Coach." Flip Saunders played point guard for the University of Minnesota before turning to professional basketball and becoming a coach. He played at Minnesota with future Basketball Hall of Famer Kevin McHale, who is now the head coach of the Houston Rockets. Saunders first became an NBA coach when McHale, then Minnesota's general manager, put him on the bench during the 1995 season. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahayas Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on the Voice of America. Coming up, a new study on air pollution in the East African region. And next, a protein found in bananas being turned into a drug that may someday be used to fight viral infections. But first, some music. Here is Deborah Debs of Cameroon with Africa Higher, Higher.
comfort but yourself upon its throne. Hey, yeah, yeah. 20 years of power.
Why?
30 plus and 14 more.
Debs of Cameroon with Africa, Higher, Higher. Researchers from the University of Southern California in the United States and Ethiopia's Addis Ababa University have joined a regional study on the effects of air pollution on health in East Africa. The findings could save thousands of lives. Ayan Bior has the story.
The World Health Organization says 3.8 million people die every year from air pollution-related diseases like stroke, heart disease, and lung cancer. As Africa becomes more developed and subsequently more dependent on things that emit pollution, like cars, trucks, and agricultural pesticides, WHO officials fear air pollution could become one of Africa's most dangerous killers. USC professor Kiras Burhani says for the first time, scientists will record air pollution data in East Africa for 5 years in neighboring Ethiopia, Kenya, and Uganda on a continuous basis.
Which will give local policymakers tangible data, local data, so that they can act on environmental health policies and they can try, for instance, to lower exposure to indoor air pollution sources.
And one of the biggest sources of indoor air pollution in East Africa is cooking stoves, which burn biomass fuels such as charcoal, crop residue, and animal dung. Burhani says studies on pollution have taken a backseat to more pressing matters like famine, drought, and political instability.
So even though people have realized, qualitatively at least, that air pollution, especially indoor air pollution from cooking and heating, is a big problem, To me, it sounds like it's a matter of priority.
Berhani says obtaining hard evidence of air pollution that is tailor-made for local communities can influence decision-making in individual households and could even one day impact national policy.
I'll give you one example. Right now, almost 90-95% of people, for instance, in Ethiopia, use biomass fuel for cooking. But it's possible that they could switch to improved cookstoves or even cleaner cookstoves that use biogas that will tremendously lower the level of air pollution. So things like this are feasible, and governments, once they have local data, high-quality data, they will be able to plan accordingly.
The World Health Organization says safe and efficient cooking stove would reduce the workload for women and children and could decrease the demand on scarce natural resources like wood and charcoal. During the first year of this five-year study, USC, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the South Coast Air Quality Management District will train researchers in East Africa to set up air monitoring stations. They'll also be trained on how to collect data. The second year of the study, researchers from Addis Ababa University will measure the impact of air pollution on the respiratory health of 9- and 10-year-olds in East Africa. Eventually, Berhani says, the study will be expanded to other East African countries.
At this point, it basically comes down to a matter of logistics and feasibility and existing connections. But we have plans to include countries like South Sudan in the future.
Results of the study are expected to be released sometime in 2020. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
A protein found in bananas is being turned into a drug that may someday be used to fight viral infections. The protein, called Banlec, has been shown to disarm a number of aggressive viruses. VOA's Jessica Berman has the story.
Bananas are one of those foods. They're a good source of all kinds of vitamins and minerals, can fight depression, ward off muscle cramps, lower blood pressure, and protect against heart attack. Now bananas could provide a new weapon against viruses. The weapon is bananalectin, or Banlec, a protein that attaches to sugar molecules and keeps viruses out of cells and prevents infection. But when scientists isolated the protein for therapeutic trials, Banlec also caused irritation and inflammation. So an international team studied the protein and identified the part that causes those side effects. With some genetic tinkering, they developed a version of Banlec, which retained the protein's antiviral properties, but without the immune response. Writing in the journal Cell, the team says it could be one of the first broad-spectrum antiviral agents to treat a variety of viruses, including HIV, hepatitis, and even the common avian influenza bug. Co-senior author David Markovitz at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor warns that you can't get the benefits of Banlec by eating a bunch of bananas.
Remember, when you're eating the banana, then the protein, which, by the way, is not our modified protein, it's the natural protein, it is going to probably be chewed up by the stomach acid. So we very much doubt that eating bananas will help you.
Markovitz says the new and improved version of Banlec must be injected. Originally, Markovitz says the banana protein was being investigated as a microbicide, an agent that women can use before sexual intercourse as a cream or gel to protect them against HIV infection. But it was shown to disarm a number of viruses, which then simply wither away if they can't infect cells. At this point, Markovitz says there are no plans to conduct human clinical trials.
You know, we're trying to help people with their health, not harm them. So it's good to be cautious about where we're going. You know, we're also very ambitious to make things work well and bring these to clinical fruition, but we're not there. You know, we're early on.
The sugar molecule that Banlec harnesses offers a unique strategy for fighting viruses, one that scientists say could be used to develop other antiviral drugs. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Key stakeholders from the wheat flour industry came together in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, in October. They celebrated business growth and shared information from 3 years of engagement under the African Alliance for Improved Food Processing Activity, a public-private partnership between the United States Agency for International Development, Partners in Food Solutions, and TechnoServe. The activity's participants worked with Ethiopia's commercial wheat millers, producers of fortified blended foods and flours, bakeries, and pasta manufacturers to expand wheat flour fortification in Ethiopia. Chronic food insecurity and malnutrition are grave problems in Ethiopia, where 2 out of every 5 children suffer from stunting, which means a lack of food and critical nutrients that impact their physical and mental growth. The availability of nutritious fortified wheat, a dietary staple in Ethiopia, is one step toward expanding access to nutritious food and reducing hunger. The activity harnessed the global technical expertise international food processors, including General Mills, Cargill, Royal DSM, and Bühler, to expand the skills of Ethiopia's growing food processing industry. Over a 3-year period, the activity supported 20 medium and large millers and processors to implement quality management systems, national standards and certification requirements, develop processes and nutritious food products tailored to market demand, strengthen financial systems, and improve business efficiencies. The activity trained staff members from 165 food processing companies and 2 government regulatory agencies on technical and business subjects such as wheat flour fortification, quality management systems, food safety, and national standards. Growth and expansion of the supported businesses brought Ethiopia the first locally produced fortified wheat flour, ensured sustainable sourcing of wheat from nearly 500,000 farmers, availed multigrain nutritious bread to the public, and facilitated access to land for expansion by farmer-owned wheat milling cooperatives. Notably, the activity hosted the President of the United States in one of the supported business sites under the U.S. government's Feed the Future initiative to showcase sustainable production of fortified weaning baby foods. This alliance, said USAID Acting Mission Director Gary Robbins, is central to our partnership in Ethiopia and the overall Feed the Future initiative. USAID will continue to work with the Ethiopian government to build its capacity to rapidly respond to periodic food insecurity, while also supporting efforts to find sustainable solutions to long-term nutritional challenges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk. Turncoat. According to the dictionary, the word turncoat means a person who stops being a member of one group in order to join another group that opposes the first group. Do you want to know more? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing Turncoat. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.